This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM's Merdeka Special is presented by Masing.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Sumitra Selvaraj. In 1975, a 21-year-old Padmavathi Krishnan was a Malay Studies undergraduate at the University of Malaya. Before the end of her second year, she was involved in an accident on campus that left her wheelchair-bound. Today, she is Senator Padmavathi Krishnan, and she joins us to share the story behind her activism for persons with disabilities over the last four decades. Padma, could you take us back to the day when the accident happened?
Yes, it was the 21st of October, 1975, and a group of students were waiting for a transport, a small bus that was supposed to come and take us to lectures. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, on that day, the driver lost control of the bus and he rammed into the group of us. And as a result, eight of us were injured, of which I had the worst injury, which was spinal injury.
And you were taken immediately to hospital, of course.
Yes, I was, yeah.
And what was your most immediate concern once you realized the extent of your injury?
Well, I had a myriad of thoughts going through my mind and, the frustration first and then, what had happened. I had been very active in sports and all that and mm-hmm. for suddenly to have lost the use of my legs, I thought to myself, no, I have to do something about, to get back as much as possible what I can do, then move forward. And first and foremost, what was in my mind was my studies.
Okay.
I had to complete that first.
And did your family share your single-minded determination in getting back to your studies?
Yes, of course. I owe a lot to my family. And, they were like in a state of shock as well, why and how it had happened to me. And mm-hmm. I had to brave myself up. I had to give them the confidence that it's okay, this had happened, and I still can carry on. And to them, yes, they gave me all the support to, do and take things one at a time.
Okay, and when you say one at a time, how did you have to kind of evolve to adapt to your new condition?
Well, it did take time, It was like when visitors came to see me, when the, doctors and nurses come to talk to me, when my family members were around, I had to put up a brave front. But then, usually at night, when I was there in the ward, mm-hmm. I was there for like some 8 months. And it was like, it's me and my situation. And, I had to deal with it. I used to cry. And, it was something which, as day went on, because the doctor said that it will take about 6 weeks for them to know whether this injury was going to be permanent. Mm-hmm. So when the days went by, it was only gradually that it dawned upon me that it was going to be permanent. So it was a battle that I was fighting within myself. And also I had, like a mission, like I had to carry on living. I had to carry on with, what is left to strengthen my arms. And I had to go for physiotherapy twice a day while I was there for 8 months. So, there was still ups and downs. Days were when I was depressed, but
I was just going to ask
show.
About that actually,
yes.
Because we're talking about the mid-1970s.
Yes.
Was there any form of perhaps mental health support that you were offered?
Well, to tell you the truth, they did assign a psychotherapist, in the team. But much later, after my stay in the hospital, when I met her, her name is Mercy Koh. I still remember her name. And when I asked her, and she said, the way I was dealing with my situation, mm-hmm. she said, she thought to herself that I did not need that psychological counseling. Right. And I don't know. I don't know how to attribute this. I was a person very interested in psychology. I used to read up books, read, magazines on psychology and all that. So it was, maybe it helped me, and maybe the type of personality and the strength, which I think I did get from my mother, is something which was inherited. So, in dealing with challenges and moving ahead, not taking a day at a time.
And during those 8 months in hospital, were your studies on hold?
It was on hold. And by the time I got out of hospital, which was the following year, 1976, May, mm-hmm. I had to start my second year all over again.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how did the university kind of support you in moving forward with your studies?
Right. Firstly, the extra year that I had to spend was borne by the fees involved was borne by the university. Mm-hmm. Secondly, there was a new residential college which was there, which had a sick bay, mm-hmm. a sick bay with an attached bathroom. And the university authorities converted that room into a student's room. And also, they allowed my sister to stay in with me. One of my sisters was working in KL, mm-hmm. and they also employed someone to look after me from morning, early morning, 7 till 5 p.m. Mm-hmm. And after 5 p.m., my sister will come back from work and she would look after me.
What was the level of accessibility for you throughout the university?
They had to make some adjustments. Like, firstly, this residential hall, mm-hmm. the room, they had to open a door, a separate entrance at the back. They put a ramp. And then the room, the bathroom was modified, whereby, you know, I could transfer myself onto a, you know, a seat mm-hmm. and bathe with assistance. Mm-hmm. And the bed was also accessible from my wheelchair. And there was something called a monkey pole, which people don't use anymore. It's a support mm-hmm. For me to pull myself up.
Before the incident had happened, did University of Malaya have any persons with disabilities as students?
Yes. I think there were one or two blind students who were taken in, and there was one student, I think, with polio, mm-hmm. but he could walk. And later, I think he became a lecturer at the Faculty of Science. Mm. Yeah. And I think for a person on a wheelchair, I think I was the first student on a wheelchair. And other modifications they made was in the arts faculty, there were three lecture theatres which I had to use all downstairs. Mm-hmm. And they had put wooden ramps over the steps.
So that you could access.
I could access. And, you know, the lady was looking after me, could help push me up. And she used to wait until my lectures were over. Then she'll take me to, you know, whatever seminar rooms where I had tutorials.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So as your studies progressed and through your third year as well, did you have an idea career-wise where you were headed?
Not really. I thought I would, after the accident happened, mm-hmm. I thought I would maybe end up doing some administrative job, become an officer. And also thought to myself, you know, it was only the campus that I was familiar with and I didn't know how things were outside the campus. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I didn't really have a fixed idea. And towards the end of the course, mm-hmm. I did, after I finished my exams, rather, I went to see the Vice-Chancellor and I said that, you know, there's a campus that I'm familiar with, mm-hmm. I would love to have a job within the campus.
You went on to work within the University of Malaya?
Yes. Initially, I was given a job whereby I had to help edit the university newsletter mm-hmm. called Budiman. And I did that for a year. And I was paid an allowance of 250 ringgit.
Wow.
But, you know, it was better than nothing. Then I thought to myself, you know, I don't think I should be, you know, getting this pay mm-hmm. for the qualification that I have.
Okay.
So then I approached him again and I said that I would like to work in a place, I mean, within the campus, wherever, which is accessible. And I was thinking of an administrative job. Then one day he said, okay, you know, he did send his officers to look around. And finally, they found that the library would be a good place for me to work in because the library had a lift for books. And luckily enough, I mean, later, there was a vacancy and I went for the interview. I went for the interview on a wheelchair and they asked me, how are you going to come to work? So I said that, I'm going to learn how to drive because the VC himself asked me to go and watch a movie called Coming Home.
Okay.
Where, you know, there was a war veteran who was using a modified car. Mm-hmm. So I went to see that and I got the idea and I'd already written to the car companies to find out. So I told them that I'm going to learn to drive. And I'm going to drive myself to work.
Yes, I remember reading a fascinating account of how challenging it was for you to get your driver's license. And we're going to get to that after a short break. I'm speaking to Senator Padmavathi Krishnan on Live and Learn for the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Stay tuned to this BFM Merdeka special presented by Masing. This BFM Merdeka special is presented by Masing.
Welcome back. I'm Sumitra Selvaraj, and this is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm chatting with Senator Padmavathi Krishnan, who is a spokesperson and tireless proponent for persons with disabilities. She's just about to share with us what she set out to do after the accident that made her a paraplegic. Padma, you were determined.
You were so determined to drive a car, and the help that you got to do this was really quite phenomenal. Perhaps you could share the story with us.
I think there was a man by the name of P.C. Pattacharji, you know, who had a motoring column in the NST. Mm-hmm. He put my letter in the paper, in that column. And one mechanical engineer from Tanchong called Paul David is the one who responded. Mm-hmm. And he got in touch with me through the newspaper and said that he was willing to modify the car. And so I bought a Datsun 120Y, mm-hmm. and he modified it. And then he taught me how to drive. So then I went for my, I had to get it approved.
Right. So what was that process like? Who did the approval?
The road transport department, the technical division of the road transport department, mm-hmm. is supposed to give the approval for any modification done to a standard car.
Had they ever seen or dealt with such a modification before?
No. So when I got in touch with the technical division head, and I invited him to, together with this person, Paul David, who modified the car, I drove, and this man was sitting next to me, and the engineer, Paul David, was at the back. Mm. So then he tested while I used my hand controls. I know how I negotiated the roundabout, how I did the emergency brake, how I used my signals, and how, from a slope, to move up and to come down, and how I did three-point turn and all that. So I was using only my hands, which had a device, one rod for the brake, which you need to press. Another one was a T-shaped metal, which when you pull, exactly like how the bicycle brake works.
Yes.
As you pull towards you, it depresses the accelerator pedal. Mm. So this was a gadget which I used with one hand. And with the left hand, I had to maneuver the steering. Mm. A knob was attached. So, that's fine. The seat belt and everything adjusted. So after he had seen me drive, and he went back, and when I called up to find out whether or not I could get approval, he said, he was very reluctant. He said, if you drive with your hands will get tired. And you'll pose a danger to the pedestrians on the street. I thought to myself, I was a bit annoyed. I said, sir, I think here's a problem, of your mindset. I think people around the world are driving modified cars.
Did you say
and
that
I think
to
because
him?
I did say it to him. And I said, it's because you haven't seen, and he was, very reluctant. He just said, just ended the conversation like that. Okay. But I didn't give up. What I did next was, I wrote to the Deputy Minister of Transport. I wrote a long letter saying that this is a car which I need. I can't get into the bus or taxi. And it was then, 1979. And I said, I need this, for me to go to work, for me to, go outstation and all that. So I went there. I took a colleague from the library and we went to see the Deputy Minister, Goh Cheng Teck, who also happened to be a former lecturer from the university. Mm-hmm. And one of my colleagues happened to know him. So when I went to see him with that letter, he said, okay, let me look into it. And then after that, about a week later, came the reply. They said, yes, it's approved, but two conditions. One is I can only drive some 60 kilometers per hour, mm-hmm. and that only I can drive in KL and PG, can't go outstation. So I accepted because at that time I was about to go overseas, to further my studies. Mm-hmm. So after that, I came back and I continued, to fight with them to say that anyone who can drive in KL and PJ can drive in any part of the world, I said.
I think so, except maybe Penang. Penang is a different animal altogether.
Yes. And, true. And I said I had to go outstation to visit, visit my family and my friends. And, if I were to do 60 km, I'll be hogging the road.
True. Yes.
Then they said, okay. Then they cancelled that off as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did learning how to drive and having a car kind of change you?
Oh, I would say it gave me the wings of freedom. To be able to drive a vehicle, to be able to move about other than my wheelchair, it was amazing. It was, like getting new wings, mm-hmm. And I'm really thankful until this day. I'm really thankful to this Paul David.
Mm. Yeah. So you were not just a librarian, though. Very, very early on, the seeds for social activism were sown in your mind. What kind of sparked that for you?
It was not something pre-planned about. It just came along the way. Mm. And what I had gone through, I was just thinking to myself, because I used to go back to the hospital for my therapy, for exercises and all that, and used to meet others. Who are in my situation. And from there, I started talking to, other persons who had spinal injury, mm-hmm. and to let them know that, you can still continue life. So it was something that came on natural. for me to share with them, you know, what can be done, and you know that there is still a future, there is still a life you can lead.
At that point, was there a formal kind of organization or a formal banding together of persons with disabilities?
And not in KL. Yes, I mean there were some organizations. Mm. I joined the Persatuan Orang Cacat Anggota Malaysia, mm-hmm. which is a general association for persons with physical disabilities. Mm-hmm. I joined that in 1979. Mm-hmm. And for spinal injured persons, no, there was no formal organization. And around that time, I used to go up and down. I used to go to Ipoh, you know, to visit my sister. Mm. And I got to know about a group of people under the Yayasan Sultan Idris Shah before the building came up. Mm-hmm. They were meeting in some small place. And I met a group of people who were interested to form a spinal wheelers club. Yeah. And one, I think she's a social worker, no, CBR, community-based rehabilitation, personnel, a girl by the name, lady by the name of Saras. Mm-hmm. She was the one who approached me and she asked me to come and talk to these people and, you know, to give them motivation talk. And I didn't know that was later called peer counseling, you know, how right. you share your experience with others so that others can learn from you. Mm-hmm. So, I think I was instrumental in forming that Spinal Wheelers Club. Mm-hmm. And then later they went on to build and have this Yayasan Sultan Idris Shah, which is doing very well mm-hmm. now in Pricham, I think, yeah.
So in the 40 years since, in the four decades since, what, in your opinion, are some of the most positive changes that have happened for persons with disabilities here in Malaysia?
Oh, positive things. Well, we have had, I think even before the Persons with Disabilities Act, we had the building bylaws, amendment to the Street and Drainage Act 133, Section 34A, mm-hmm. particularly refers to public buildings whereby accessibility, you know, should be provided. And this was the initiative actually of Tun Mahathir. Mm-hmm. He's the one who was interested, and he made sure that these building bylaws were formulated and passed. And this was passed in 1990. Yeah. So that was a major breakthrough as well. And also, you know, in other areas, you know, special education needs was also being looked into. And employment, mm-hmm. yeah.
The Act itself, the Persons with Disabilities mm-hmm. Act itself, was quite a linchpin, wasn't it, in terms of being able to effect real change?
Yes. Although a lot of people say that it's not effective because it doesn't have penalties, you know, imposed on people who don't follow. It is because I think it is effective. Because the, you know, even in the preamble, the explanations, the definitions and the scope, the definition of persons with disabilities is taken from the United Nations, the UNCRPD, Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Mm-hmm. And throughout the Act, the word shall is used. And shall, interpreted, people in the legal field will know, mm-hmm. shall means it's mandatory. You have to, yes. So, I think now it's been about 11 years since the Act was out, mm-hmm. and we are now on the verge of amending it. And we're going to have a workshop next week, and we're going to give input, and definitely we will also be looking into the offences and penalties.
Perhaps you could let me know, besides the offences and penalties, what are the sorts of amendments are you hoping to see in the Act?
Okay, there is one particular section, if I'm not mistaken, section 41, which absolves, government departments and government personnel of any wrongdoing or any contravention of the Act. Ah. So that we are definitely going to remove it totally, mm-hmm. so that, so that it becomes a fair playing field. Mm. That anyone, be it private sector, individual, NGO, or the government, mm-hmm. who do not comply with the Act would have to pay some kind of penalty. Mm-hmm. I mean, would have to face the consequences.
I know from many conversations that I've had with you and articles that I've read, you're somebody who doesn't just believe in fighting for the differently abled or persons with disabilities. You don't only believe in the idea of equality, you actually more believe in the idea of unity.
Yes.
Could you tell me a little bit about this? Why does this word mean so much to you?
Yeah, okay. Unity is something which we all aspire to have. And we're always so proud and we boast of having a multi-religious, multicultural society here in Malaysia, you know, and this is always, you know, we tell other people, you know, and you say, okay, this is a melting pot of, you know, different cultures, different races and all that. But how and why this issue of racial unity has undergone so many changes, you know, ups and downs. And looks like, you know, when you look back, you know, when if I can take you back to my time when I was growing up in Alostar, although I was born in Kuala Krapahang, I grew up in Alostar. And, you know, there we had a multiracial neighborhood, and you know, we used to play with each other, Indians, Chinese, and Malays. And you know, these differences did not matter so much. We respected each other's religion and we respected each other as a person, and things were all very fine. And that is why when you talk to people who are 60 years and older, it is, you know, that background we came from, you know, and then along the way, so many things happened, and of late, even more things have happened to keep us apart. And if I may say...
What do you think has changed in the fabric of our society? What has gone so wrong?
Right. I was also asked this question at another forum, which was held in the parliament, a general one. Okay. Maybe policies that were introduced, okay, maybe the threshold was the 1969 racial riots, after which the then Prime Minister, the Abdul Rahman Razak, realized that something had to be done to foster unity. And he, you know, to bring back the country together, to have a more united Malaysia, they had to have this Dasar Economic Baru, yeah, the new economic policy, yes, which was supposed to be from 1970 to 1990. And because at that time, the people, races were identified by the jobs, economic activities that they do. So this was to break that and to make sure that everybody had equal participation. And also, the two main objectives were, one, to eradicate poverty, and secondly, to not to identify each race by the economic activity.
Yes.
And it also stated that 30% participation of Bumiputra. But I thought to myself then, why don't people talk about the 70%, which is open to all?
Yes.
So it was a very good policy, which was supposed to be from 70 to 90. But then again, if it had been followed through closely, I think we would have a Malaysia which is different from what we have now. So I would say that, you know, the subsequent prime ministers who came in, and Atun Mahathir, who's now, you know, the PM, at that time, he had different ideas, you know. Instead of 30% participation, you know, he was more interested in creating a handful of Malay businessmen, of which, you know, some succeeded and some did not. And then there was also some policies that were introduced, you know, in the education and also in the civil service, you know, which did upset the racial harmony and the racial, the equality,
and
you know.
What we have now is divisiveness more than anything else.
Yes, yes. And of course, you know, all along, and then the rise of the political parties, you know, race, the race based and some religious based, and then you know, the subsidies were given to then, you know, the people who supported UMNO, and subsidies were not given to people from past, you know, such kind of things did matter, and you know, it became more divisive, you know, within a particular race as well, you know, and that, I think it you know, it was not very healthy.
Can the divisiveness be destroyed? Is it possible at all to be a truly Malaysian society?
I think we can, provided the political will is there. And now, after all has happened, I mean, don't have to go through all the stages from 1990 right up to now. Okay, we come forward to what happened last year. A very big change took place.
And a welcome change.
A welcome change, I would say. A welcome change took place. And we would not have imagined, I think, nowhere in the world that this has happened. The very same person who, was there for 22 years, during which, like I mentioned, you know, so many things happened, is now back again. And he is about the best person to put things back into perspective and back on the right track. And if there is political will, as I say, it definitely can be achieved. Mm. Unity, racial unity is very, very important. A lot of people think, oh, racial unity means, you know, you speaking each other's languages,
going
you're dressing up in
houses,
each other's clothes.
Yep, yep, no, I agree.
No, way beyond that. Mm-hmm. It is accepting each other.
Not tolerating.
Not tolerating, yes.
I cannot
yes.
stand this word,
tolerating. Just on the surface, mm. unless you accept. We accept we have a right to live. We're put here for a purpose. Mm. You know, and let us make the best of this one life that God has given us. And I believe it can be done.
Mm. What is your hope for Malaysia as we move further into an era of new governance?
My hope is if everybody can feel for Malaysia, you know, the sense of belonging should be there. We all belong to one country. We all contribute to make our country great. And if everybody can accept this as a role, I mean, starting from politicians right up to, families, communities, teachers, especially teachers, children even, and the youngsters. You know, if you can accept, I mean, it's good to see there are so many positive things that are happening. You know, we want a successful Malaysia. So if we can focus on that, I think it can be achieved.
Well said, Senator Bathma. Well said. I've been speaking to Senator Bathma Vadikrishnan and her hopes for Malaysia in the run-up to our National Day and Malaysia Day. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn segments, you can download the podcasts on our BFM app or on Spotify. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
BFM's Merdeka Special is presented by Mossing. Reinvent spaces, enhance life.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.